This is The Conversation, a podcast that goes behind the scenes and between the lines of the art worlds, including those in Texas. I'm Michael Shaw. Welcome to the show. It is episode 239, part two of two with Rainey Knutson of Glass Tire. In case we didn't mention it last time, she's out of there. She's retiring. She's stepping down in June from the Houston-based long-running art magazine Glass Tire. And she talks about that. She talks about her commencement speech tour. It's actually her series of talks around the state of Texas to people that she wants to hopefully work for Glass Tire, among other people. So great conversation once again. And yes, we did sort of got a little on the dark side in part one. Part two, there is talk of Houston heroes. There is talk of the evils of Facebook, which I encourage you to listen to very closely to. And there is ultimately a note of optimism at the end. So look forward to that and so much more. Before we get into the conversation, a few things that I want to mention to you. One is I am going to be in Chicago for an art event coming up this week, Monday through essentially Wednesday. I leave early Thursday. So if you are in Chicago and you have recommendations for me, or maybe you even want to escort me around to a few galleries and whatnot, that would be awesome. Reach out to me. My very close Chicago-based friend Josh Rogers is going to be in Los Angeles during that time. So yeah, would love a brief host for, you know, a couple hours to see a few shows if you're free, ideally on Wednesday. Please reach out to me. Okay, I'll tell you more about that event at some point after it's gone down, because I don't know what's going to happen exactly. Want to mention also, before I tell you what's going to be on the exciting back end today, that if you are not already a convert to my other podcast, How I Get By, which was launched back in September, there is a episode that I think you will want to hear. It's actually another two-part episode with Caitlin, who is a dancer, a modern dancer, one and choreographer, one in which some of her content would apply to the art context, it seems. And she works at Google. That's her day job. She's a software engineer at Google. So highly recommend you check out that two-part episode, either How I Get By on whatever platform you listen to podcasts on, or you can just go to How I Get By podcast.com. All right. So on the back end today, before we jump in with Rainey part two, I am going to tell you about how much you need to make to afford the median home cost in the bigger cities across this country, United States, and then how that jives with the spec house next door to me that you may have heard me mention in the past. It's on the market now. It's not necessarily completely done, but it is on the market. So I'm going to tell you about those two things. And then I'm going to get into the old news, concluding with Tim Schneider's piece, What the College Admissions Scandal Has to Do with the Art World. All of that coming up on the back end. Please stay tuned. Thank you for being here, and I will talk to you then.
Well, and this is sort of the larger issue of the world we're all swimming in right now, where, I mean, I read recently that people today are receiving, I think, six times as much information as they were in 1960. I read this somewhere recently, which makes perfect sense. I mean, if you think about it, and it's very easy in such an environment to think like, well, shit, why even bother? But if you don't bother, then, you know, what, I don't know what else you're going to do. You know, I think expectation of a great sized audience. I'm doing a farewell tour of Texas and giving a talk. And one of the things I talk about, I sort of touch on this, is social media and people who are able to use it really well. And the person, I think, in my field who has used it exceedingly well, of course, is Jerry Saltz, you know.
Yeah.
Jerry Saltz, if there is such a thing as an art critic who is a household name, Jerry Saltz is it in America. And I'm almost jealous of the way that he is able to so cheerfully and unaffectedly use social media and put himself out there and allow himself to be embarrassed by it or whatever. I just recoil from social media. I'm off Facebook now completely, and God, my life is so much better.
Mazel tov.
Yeah, thank you. It took a couple of tries, but really, everyone, it's worth it.
Yeah.
But like Jerry Saltz is so successful because of social media in many ways. And I mean, I think he's a great writer too. I don't ascribe to the Jerry Saltz is not smart school of thought, which I don't agree with that. Although I don't agree with everything he says. But social media has been critical to his success. Social media is critical to Donald Trump's success. We would not have Donald Trump as president if it weren't for social media. So these people who are able to rise to the top of this scrum of information that we're all swimming in, while you and I, who are not rising to the top of the scrum of information necessarily, mm-hmm. It skews the perception of what makes life worth living and what makes work worthwhile, I think. To me, my work is worthwhile even if it's a relatively small audience.
So I'm glad you brought up your farewell tour, which is coming up very soon, the first one, right? So mm-hmm. what do you want your audiences to take away from the social media aspect of your talk?
Well, I hope they all quit Facebook.
Okay.
I lay out exactly why Facebook specifically has destroyed journalism in America.
Mm-hmm.
Well, globally. So I say that and I laugh, but it's true. I think that, you know, social media, my husband, who is able to successfully use social media and not get sucked into it, it is, on the one hand, it's just a platform. All it is a communications tool, like, and we've had other communications tool that everybody freaked out about, like the telegraph or the telephone or what have you. But obviously the magnification of your impact is so much greater in both directions. And I think that, the difference between social media and previous forms of communication or previous technologies is that it is designed with this dopamine feedback loop to be addictive. It is designed
right.
to scratch our little ego itch. And that makes it very suspect to me.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of your other big bullet points that you're going to be talking about in your talk?
I talk about the history of Glass Tower. I mean, the main thing is, I think everyone's losing their mind right now. Everyone is losing their mind and nobody is having any fun. And oh, by the way, that's not the first time in human history that that has happened. And so I talk about a specific period where things were just a complete shit show. I've started reading Michel de Montaigne's essays. Are you familiar with Michel de Montaigne's essays? This is the guy who coined the term essay. He was French. He lived in the 16th century.
Mm-hmm.
And to make a long story very short, you know, when I think of the 16th century, because I studied literature, English literature, I think of Shakespeare. I think of the Tudors, or I think of like Spanish colonial expansion. You never think of France in that century. You think of France later on.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason you never think of France in the 1500s is because it was a shit show. It was St. Bartholomew's Massacre. And I think something like 3 million people died in the wars between Protestants and Catholics at the time. And so it was a very dangerous, bad time, weak king, bad century for France. Meanwhile, you have this guy in southwest France writing the most incredible humanist, liberal humanist essays. You know, it's like the first writing of this type that we would now recognize almost as blog writing, where he's writing on all sorts of subjects, these amazing essays. And what I take from that, I'm distilling a lot of his writing down, but what I take from that is that it is possible, even in the midst of a shit show, to live a good life. And that's the main message I hope to give to people. You know, I'm talking about Texas, I'm talking about art, I'm talking about the internet and online journalism and all of that, and telling funny stories about receiving death threats and, you know, libel lawsuits and all that. But really, we're all freaked out by what's going on in the world today. And I'm not saying it's not going to get worse. I think it very well, most likely will. But that doesn't mean that we can't and must give up on living good lives ourselves, in whatever way that means.
with a subtext being at least start with getting off Facebook and maybe consider minimizing your time on other platforms, perhaps?
Well, with the subtext of being find a way to be a human being amongst other human beings that's as clean and generous as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that social media lends itself towards dirtiness and lack of generosity. Dirtiness, selfishness, cruelty. Our worst instincts are rewarded on social media. And we all have those terrible trolling instincts.
Right.
There's no reason to engage in that, though. He says the shit talker from Texas.
So is this farewell tour of yours, in a way, like a commencement address to your readers around the state or something? How would you put it?
Well, I've never done anything like this. I like public speaking a lot, but I haven't done that much of it. And so when someone gave me the idea, it wasn't my idea even, it was a way to cap off this effort, this project that I've done the last 18 years, because I'm stepping down from Glass Tire. I announced that I'm stepping down, and actually this summer I will no longer be the publisher.
Right.
And so it's a way to look back on where we've come from, how much things have changed,
mm-hmm.
What is the work that we're actually doing here? What is it that we're trying to accomplish? How can that continue to be accomplished? It's also, frankly, thinly veiled recruiting for writers, because I'm mostly speaking at universities. So I'm trying to talk to the next generation about the importance of writing about art. Writing is thinking. So when you're writing about art, you're thinking about art.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that is a worthwhile thing to think about.
Yeah. It sounds indeed like a little bit of a commencement talk.
I guess it is. I do reference the Big Lebowski. I do have what's the name of the actor? David Thewlis. It's Sandra about the Biennale. I mean, I do work.
Right.
I do work in a few jabs at the art world.
Good, good. Well, before I don't want to jump to your retirement from Glass Tire just yet, because I think that's a good place to wrap up. I think maybe since you did mention social media, maybe we can cover a little bit of your piece about museums, since that's obviously a big part of it. And you refer to the writer Rob Horning and his essay, which was in the magazine Even. And I'm just going to jump to his the most intense line that you quote, which is, "We can dispense with the idea that visitors come to museums to experience transcendence, or to cultivate their eye, or to participate in a novel social configuration. Instead, visitors are presumed to be brand ambassadors, affiliate marketers who will eagerly promote an experience in exchange for perceiving themselves to be influential." And then you respond by writing, "Museums have become consumer playgrounds with something that was once understood as art, filling in as the backdrop. But so what? Museums had been, still want to be, the new churches, and now, ironically, museums and churches have both become the new vaudeville halls, exhorting us to feel good with happy, clappy, immersive experiences that involve video projections and interactive performances." I really wanted to get that happy, clappy line in some way or another. So, I mean, this is kind of in the context of the ice cream museum, you know, that you mentioned. And then there's, here in LA, certainly the Broad is the most notorious for being overridden with selfie pictures. And by the way, Houston is a you know, in not only in Texas, but in the country at large, is a pretty big museum city. So do you feel like it's pretty much the same type of issue, problem there as it is everywhere else?
Oh yeah, this is human beings. Interestingly, I mean, it's funny you mentioned the Broad, because I have a lot of admiration for, not the entirety of the collection or whatever, but I think that program is pretty sincere. When you say it's a selfie thing, is it because of the architecture, or just because people are taking pictures of themselves in front of, you know, Christopher Wool or whatever? Or
Jeff Koons, yeah, the flowers. I mean, I know a couple of people who are guards slash docents there. And yeah, I mean, it's a problem. I mean, there a Robert Therian table was bumped into.
Oh, yeah.
With somebody's wheelchair. You know, I mean, shit is happening all the time there.
What I love about that is whenever you deal with actual artists with their actual work, how cavalier they are about it. they don't care if you bump into it. Of course, museums, I understand. I think, to me, people taking pictures of themselves in front of art, museums have just become a form of shopping. When, after 9/11, when George W. Bush told us all to keep shopping so that the economy could keep going, and I didn't make this, I'm not the first person to point this out, but, you know, think of that compared to, you know, FDR's response after Pearl Harbor. This is sort of what we've become. I don't blame George W. Bush for, I mean, that's what the economy runs on, consumer spending, consumer debt. Anyway, so back to museums and how this manifests itself in museums is that museums, it's not about getting outside of yourself. It's about shopping for an idea of yourself. You know, I think that people are only getting outside of themselves maybe at the movies anymore. And maybe not even then. I don't know. I'm saying this and I'm not sure that I agree with myself.
Well, let me ask you this while you're meditating on that a bit more. When you go see shows in Houston, museum shows in Houston, are they often the press previews, or do you go then again later? With the question basically being, presumably you are still somebody who's trying to have that genuine experience looking at the work, and to what extent are you being prohibited or distracted from doing so because of your fellow visitors?
Well, nobody likes to go to a crowded museum. So I do, I mean, I do avoid museums when I know they're going to be really crowded. Although sometimes it's nice to go to the Museum of Fine Arts Houston on a Thursday because that's their free day. And it's just nice to see who comes to the museum when it's free. But no, it's hard to look at art in a crowd for sure. I guess my point in writing that article was not about museums being crowded, although museums, you know, have cultivated being crowded because that's their metric of success. Mm-hmm. It was more really about the type of work that they're showing. It's work that's geared towards crowdation. It's work that's geared towards packing them in. It's marketed that way. And so there's not a whole lot of pleasure in standing in line for 45 minutes for a 45-second art experience. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, we need to quote your, speaking of which, as for audience members, Horning does suggest that they might not buy into museums' vacuous selfie backdrops forever when he comments that knockoffs like the Museum of Ice Cream and Rabbit Town and Sri Lanka, quote, are too self-evidently contrived to have much lasting appeal, unquote. But surely the same goes for the museum experience, even one by a quote unquote real artist that involves a long line followed by less than a minute in some tarted up groove closet.
Obvious reference to Kusama's Infinity Rooms.
Right. And the obvious go-to whenever you're talking about lines to see a show these days.
I know. And it's... Again, monkey see, monkey do. I mean, they see that it's successful somewhere else. They're like, oh, shit, we got to get one of those. I don't even blame that work, even though I find it incredibly trite and unsuccessful in person. It photographs so much better than it views in person, which is not a bad thing to say necessarily about art. You know, I don't mind art photographing well.
Mm-hmm.
I think the role of museums, when I finished up that article, I said, you know, who, aside from all the hand-wringing about what museums are and what museums should be, and should they be empty tombs of old stuff that we're protecting? Should they be, you know, new age malls with shopping and food and crowds of people, which is what they're trying to be. I think what's interesting, and this speaks again to what's happened with art and how many artists there are and how many schools there are producing artists now. Artists want to get into museums now. This was sort of the final point I think I made in that article. The artists want these like mega things, and it's understandable why. I mean, that's a measure of success for sure. But I'm interested in the artists who want nothing to do with any of that.
Yeah.
It's impossible to talk about these hyper-successful, you know, long lines of waiting museum installations without it feeling suspect. It's without that experience becoming suspect. I saw that Ragnar Kjartansson's The Visitor, I think it's called The Visitor, is that 9-channel video at the Broad, actually, for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And there was not a line to get into that. And it's funny, I saw it with a friend who thought it was just insufferably, you know, adolescent and pedantic. I thought it was incredibly beautiful and moving. I loved it. That was an example of something that I felt had a lot of sincerity and beauty and joy. All words that, of course, are terribly suspect for a lot of artists. I get it. But... That was incredibly, what's the word I'm looking for? That I connected with, you know, on a human level, that it resonated with me. Maybe I'm a pedantic adolescent, I don't know.
Well, did you have a further debate with your friend about it, or did you just kind of leave it at agreeing to disagree?
No, I understood his point. It's a bunch of hipsters in a ramshackle, run-down old mansion. I mean, I get it. There's a lot to just want to put your finger down your throat about with that. But I thought it was really lovely. I thought it was lovely. And the way he ended, I thought it was about transcendence. I thought it was about death. I thought, you know, at the end when they go to the field and they go off into the field after the cannon goes off and they're sort of singing in the field and then it slowly shuts down as the person goes around turning off all the cameras. To me, it was very narrative, actually. And here I'm going to expose my weakness for narrative art. This comes from, maybe from having a literature background, I don't know, but I read something about the arc of a lifetime in that piece.
Huh. Yeah, you mentioned the way that you closed out the piece, and I think it bears reading a little bit from... let me see if I can give it a little context. Let's even drop the term artist to make it easier to distinguish the shit from the shinola. There are people out there looking at and interpreting the world, making stuff out of thin air, who are not engaging much with the art world. What are they doing? What does their work look like? How are they distributing it? Would we even be able to recognize what they are doing as art? I suspect that great artists are running from the art world mess so fast that nobody knows what they are doing or where. Meanwhile, nobody really knows what art will be in the post-camera, post-internet, post-smartphone, post-Twitter world. But they sense it won't be, it no longer is, what we have understood it to be for millennia. I just wanted to mention that because, and this kind of goes back to what you were sort of alluding to before, how does an artist who's working and by running away from all of those things sort of keep working without being in a vacuum? I think that's, I mean, I suppose, and maybe to some extent there are communities in Houston like this, but maybe it's just for the community. Is that kind of what you see on the other side of that example?
Yes, probably. To do what I'm talking about an artist doing is an act of tremendous courage, tremendous will. And it requires a willingness to turn your back on everything that is conventionally understood as success in the art world. And very, very, very few artists are able to do that. And to be able to, first of all, to be willing and able to do it, and then to be willing and able, and then to be able to do it well on top of that is very, very difficult. I think that there is great painting out there. There is great, great drawing. You know, there's great all of the plastic arts, all of the art forms that, when I say things that have been traditionally understood as art, two-dimensional rectilinear objects that go on your wall, or three-dimensional freestanding objects that sit on your coffee table or on a pedestal, whatever, are out there. But I think that I have to believe that there are people out there right now who, as I said before, see the world in a different way and are looking at this insanity that we're all living in right now and are doing something that has nothing to do with the Armory Fair or the Whitney Biennial or Made in LA or what have you, you know. And that sounds like I'm painting New York and LA as impossible places to do this. I'm not saying that whatsoever. I'm just saying, you know, the insider art world.
Right.
I think that this argument, I know, sounds incredibly naive to people who swim in that world. And it's like, honey, this is where the action is. And they are right. That's where the action is, in the sense of that's where the money is and the parties are and the glamour and all that. But I'm always all I care about is what will matter 300 years from now, from this period. Mm-hmm. What will have resonated at that point. And it's not going to be the vast majority of what we see and celebrate and spend lots of money on, you know? And being able to see that stuff, that's the whole trick. That's what I've been working 20 years trying to get to a point where I can see it. Mm. It's very, very difficult. It's very difficult. You know, my fundamental skepticism of conventional thinking, I guess, it sounds just adolescent, I suppose, but I don't buy into the ideas of success that are generally bought into in the art world, you know, the metrics of success. I don't buy into a museum is successful because it's cramming people in. I don't buy into an artist is successful because, you know, the prices of their works look like a Moore's law curve. The artists that I'm writing about right now, ironically, most of his work is on Facebook. I'm going to have to write about him. I haven't even asked him if I can get permission to post the videos on YouTube, because I don't even have a Facebook account really anymore. So,
did you discover him through Facebook?
No, this is somebody I know in Houston, but where he is putting his work out there is on Facebook.
Wow.
And I'm going to have to tell him, like, I want to do something about this current body of work, but I've got to do it something that's not Facebook for all the people like me who refuse to log on to Facebook unless I have to look at your videos.
Right.
So here, this is somebody who, you know, is not represented by any gallery.
This is the closest example to the type of person making art that you are describing that you can think of right now, right?
Yeah, I mean, one of the ideas about making art is this idea of your art is your life, this Gesamtkunstwerk, right? Where it's not just, that's not just an object that you've like thrown yourself into. It's like your entire life is your artwork. And so part of that is your basic survival and just how you make money. And so what this person does is run a space in Houston. The artist is named Jim Pirtle, and his space is called Notesville, which is Houston spelled backwards. And it's been there for about 20 years. And I think that it really is an artwork. This bar/performance space is an artwork unto itself. And the things that he does in this space are his art. And he has nothing to do with the conventional art world. Doesn't need it. You know, makes his living outside of it. Doesn't teach in it. Doesn't sell in it. Doesn't have anything to do with it, except the fact that this all may be spitting in the wind. He may not be remembered 300 years from now doing it the way he's doing it, but he's doing it authentically. Mm-hmm. And he's doing work that I think is really brilliant, too.
And how did you come across him?
Oh, I've known him forever because he runs this space. In fact, Notesuo had opened right when I moved back to Houston in 1998. He had just recently opened it at that time. And it was in this building in downtown Houston, which was just starting to not be a wasteland in the late 90s. It was just starting, the first like downtown living was starting to happen at that time. And he bought this old building on Main Street in downtown Houston, which had been this crummy shoe store, I think. And it says the home of Easy Credit in huge neon lights on the side of the building. And it still says that, which I love. And turned it into this just funny place where, you know, bands from all over the world come to play all kinds of music. And it's just, it's radical. Radical hospitality, radical openness. All kinds of people go there. It's an interesting place. So I'm not telling young artists, go open a bar if you're not inclined to do so. I'm just saying there are ways to skin the cat if you really want to get creative, and you have to be brave, and you have to not already be saddled with crushing debt, unfortunately.
Can you remind me of the guy in Houston who started the sort of housing community block?
Project Row Houses. Yeah, that's Rick Lowe, Project Row Houses. In fact, he won a MacArthur.
Right, okay. Was that this last round? Or a while ago?
I think it was
last year or the year before. It was maybe a couple of years ago now. But no, Rick was originally from Alabama and had played basketball at University of Alabama. So he was really a very good basketball player. And I'm not sure how he ended up in Houston, but he's been here for a very long time. And he was part of an artist scene in the 80s that was located in this old warehouse. It was called the Commerce Street Artist Warehouse. And he was sort of tangentially associated with that. Actually, he's the same age as Jim Pirtle, this other artist I'm talking about. And so Rick, who's African-American, realized that there was this incredible rich history of these shotgun houses. They're called shotgun houses, which for anybody who's listening who doesn't know, it's like a one or two room long skinny house, so named because if you shoot a shotgun in the front door, it'll go all the way through the back door. And so this was the housing in this particular neighborhood, the Third Ward of Houston. And Rick, it wasn't just Rick, actually. There was a group of artists who all together said, let's take some of these houses and turn them into artist spaces and spaces for art. And it's grown, and over the years, it's added a lot of community outreach aspects to it. So it has this whole young mother thing and architectural thing and housing thing. And over the years, I think the emphasis on visual art has ebbed and flowed. It's at a flow right now. There's a great curator, Ryan Dennis, there. So yeah, Project Row Houses is really important. What's happened now, of course, like everywhere else, that neighborhood now has gotten really bougie and expensive, and property values are going up. And so the traditional texture and feeling of that neighborhood is changing.
I was just wondering if when he maybe first started doing that, if that maybe would qualify as the sort of type of thinking outside the box, running away from the art world kind of sensibility that you were describing.
Oh, absolutely. I think Rick would call it a social sculpture. Absolutely.
And for what it's worth, when you were originally talking about these people who turn their backs, you know, for lack of a better term, the one artist that came to mind who I had read more extensively about very recently and only knew just a very vague thumbnail version of generally prior to that is the artist Lee Lozano, working in New York in the late 60s. She seems like somebody who really turned her back and went full bore into her project.
There was just an article about her, wasn't there?
Not that I saw, if it was recent.
I feel like there was I feel like I just read something about Lee Lozano. I read these aggregators, so I can never remember where something originally was. Never mind. I can't find it. I'm not seeing it in my email because I think I forwarded it to somebody. Yes, to your point, I think it can be done anywhere. I think it could be done in New York even today, even as far out as artists have gotten pushed from the center of the city. Mm-hmm. You know, artists by nature, like I said, artists are entrepreneurial, they're resourceful, they have to be. They find a way. They always find a way, which is why artists are, you know, constantly going into neighborhoods and making that neighborhood ultimately unlivable for themselves and for the residents who are there. You know, smart developers follow artists.
I think a really, it sounds, the way that I took when you said they always find a way was much more specifically attached to this hidden genius, you know, sensibility that you were sort of describing. But I think we should expand that, be clear that we're expanding that to mean anything, including just continuing to make their work despite, you know, all the reasons that they shouldn't.
Yeah, and I let me just be clear. I can think of off the top of my head quite a few amazing artists in Texas who have conventional teaching jobs, who have tenured, you know, or tenure track teaching jobs. So it is absolutely possible to do something that's more, obvious or conventional as a way of making a living as an artist and still make great work. I think it's hard when you have tenure to continue making great work, but that's a whole other subject. So I'm not making an argument I'm not saying that artists have to turn their back. I'm not saying any artists have to do anything. I'm just saying that if you want to make great work, and if you want to keep that third eye squeegeed so that you can make really great work and not just make something for the marketplace, you know, you have to be willing to sacrifice to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or just be constitutionally incapable of, you know, going along to get along, as it were.
Since you did use art in a very broad way towards the beginning of the conversation, I feel like, would it be fair to say that Bill Hicks is maybe the greatest artist that Houston ever produced?
Oh, I think he's up there for sure. I always hesitate the greatest. I hesitate to say the greatest because I'm like, there's some really great jazz musicians and different people. No, but I mean, yeah, I mean, if anyone listening to this is unfamiliar with Bill Hicks, I can't tell you how many times since he has died I have wished he was here. It's hard to remember, but Bill Hicks was not alive during the contested election in 2000. And I remember when all that was happening, thinking like, oh my God, I wish Bill Hicks were here to comment on this. We need him. And we just need him and need him and need him. But, you know, and people say, oh, well, he's irreplaceable. No, there's other great voices out there. There's other honest, fearless, brilliant people out there. There's other comedians and great minds looking at the world and seeing it clearly and distilling it for the rest of us.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah.
So he was a lot. So he was very great.
Yeah, he was. I appreciate it and I recognize how many comedians, you know, revel in his work. So I just thought I would mention him again. But
he's great. Go look up his stuff on gun control. That's my favorite.
Right, right.
Listening audience.
Yeah, it's something involving a pendant that is one of his good punchlines. But So you're going to do this farewell tour and then you're going to be done with Glass Tire, not for any controversial reason, but simply because it's time and you've been there a long time. And when we spoke before, it sounded like you were kind of excited about the openness of what might happen next. But if I were to prod you a bit, you know, is it really that open-ended, or do you have some emails and phone numbers that you're going to be utilizing, you know, come June?
Well, in some ways it is that open-ended. I mean, my background is in art, and I obviously, know a whole lot of people, certainly in the Texas art scene. And, you know, what excites me with art is, like I said, just great art. And if there were a way to fearlessly help artists actualize projects and get that done in a way that is not looking to all the other places, that is not just looking to the New Museum or looking to the Hammer or looking to, you know, wherever, that is something that would really, really be exciting to me. But, you know, I if I'm honest, I honestly, truly don't know what I'm going to do. I am a little bit burned out. I have been doing this for 18 years, and so I'm planning to take some time off this summer. In 18 years, I think I've had two-week vacations. And there's been, you know, downtime, of course, and other time down. But, you know, I'd love to just to really take a couple of months and step away from the madness and the unceasing grind of publishing on the internet. It never goes away. It never shuts down. You always have to be feeding that beast. So to take a short break from that is really nice. You know, if I were able to just take a year off and write a book, I would do it. But I think right now I'm going to be doing something else probably.
Will you go away for a while?
Not that long, probably. I mean, I need to work, and I like to work. When you say go away, do you mean travel?
Yeah. Just like get away from the city for a little while.
Oh yes, absolutely. Oh no, I'm talking with my family about taking a trip. We always like to try and go places we've never been, and we like to go places that are not necessarily the sexy destinations, I suppose. A friend of mine recently mentioned that she and her family were thinking about going to like Eastern Canada. And I thought, you know, and I know that Toronto, a lot of people go to Toronto, but I've never been to Toronto. You know, I've never been to the capital. I've never been to Montreal. So that would be fun. I don't know. I've never been to the Twin Cities, and I really want to go there. So anyway, yes, I will be traveling for sure. And I will be, I'm actually going to go to Comic-Con in July, the Comic-Con in San Diego. Comic-Con is its own crazy subgenre, subculture.
And does that mean you're in some way a comic aficionado?
No, I am not whatsoever, but there is a child in my life who is. And this is, I will be going as a tourist / semi-reluctant chaperone. But no, I'm not reluctant at all. I'm actually really looking forward to it. It's funny. The whole comic thing in America and the Marvel Cinematic Universe and all these movies is just amazing.
Hmm. Does your child have a particular product that he's most interested in?
You know, it shifts. It changes all the time. But, I mean, Black Panther was hugely resonant. It'll go through phases where, like, DC is cool this month, and then DC's not cool, and Marvel's cool this month, and then Marvel's not cool. If anyone listening has not seen, I haven't seen it yet. I really want to see the animated Spider-Man movie that came out, I think, in December. It's supposed to be incredible. So I think it did win the Oscar for Best Animated Film. So that's of the superhero movies, that's the one I'm personally most excited to see.
Right, yeah.
I am disturbingly familiar with this genre. I did not used to know anything about any of this. A lot of gray matter has been dedicated to parsing the differences between the various nemeses of Spider-Man.
Well, that's a very odd place to wrap up, but I guess that's where we are.
I have nothing more to say. I feel optimistic and positive about the world in a way that I didn't maybe a couple of years, even a year ago. And I don't think most people feel that way. I think people feel like we're going to hell in a handbasket. And I understand empirically why that could be so, why that is arguably so. But I also think we're making progress. People are making progress. It's hard. I don't know. I think it's possible to live a good life in the midst of a shit show.
What do you attribute your optimism to?
I mean, the less time you spend engaging with people anonymously online, and the more time you spend engaging with people in the meat space, as we call it, face-to-face, sharing air, watching the tiny minutiae of their facial expressions, hearing their voices, the more connection you're going to have with your fellow humans.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that sounds like I'm a Luddite. It's not that I don't use email or, I mean, I'm on Instagram, but I think that if we really make an effort to talk to people in person, it really makes a difference.
Sure.
And I've been making an effort to do that. I just consciously was like, okay, I'm going to set up coffees with people. I'm going to go, you know, into galleries when I know it'll be quiet and I can chit chat. I'm going to do, you know, and it's so satisfying.
Right.
And I think I had lost that in my life at a certain point.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I think that's, and I don't think you're a Luddite at all. It's been lovely talking to you, Rani. Thank you so much.
Oh, Michael, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And we're out.
We're out. How long was that? An hour?
Thank you very much again to Rani. Hope you guys enjoyed that, found that illuminating, inspiring, and heartwarming. And so let's move on to real estate, not related to Houston in this case. And then I will get to the house next door to me, maybe do a little almost oversharing, which should make for good radio. So before we get to how much you need to make to buy a median price home and to the Tim Schneider piece, what the college admission scandal has to do with the art world, I do want to remind you that this is a listener-supported show. Really appreciate your donations. Thank you if you have donated recently. I want to thank Carly Smith of River Gallery here in Los Angeles for leading the charge of the new $10 a month membership on Patreon. It's a way to support the show with just giving up a couple of $5 lattes a month. And if you do it ongoing, it really, really supports us and keeps the show going and in good stead. So, you know, would really appreciate you jumping on there as well. If something more short-term is better for you, of course, there's PayPal and Venmo and good old-fashioned check. If you donate $30 or more to the show, you will, of course, get the bonus episodes. You could get a P-word bumper sticker and more. But if you want to find out all the benefits you can get, definitely check out the Patreon page with the new $10 a month membership level. And speaking of donations, thank you also to Christopher West of the Indianapolis Gallery, Christopher West Presents, for joining the conversation supporting team. Very much appreciated. You can, of course, also support the show in other ways, though I do appreciate the financial support. You can spread the word, tell everyone you know how much you love this show. You can, of course, leave a great review on iTunes or whatever platform you use. And you can follow the show at Artist Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. Thank you very much for doing so. You can, of course, also let us know what you think of this episode and any other that you've heard. So how much do you need to make to buy a median price home in one of the 50 largest American cities? This caught my eye. It's in the New York Times, but it's also in a couple of other places. It's a report from HSH.com. It says the report shows how much you need to make to qualify for a mortgage for a median price home in the 50 largest American cities. The calculations take into account home prices in each of those cities in the fourth quarter of 2018, as well as a 30-year fixed rate mortgage rate, property taxes, and homeowners insurance. The national median home price last year was $257,600, which requires an annual income of $61,454. And so by comparison, here are, I'm going to go from the most affordable to the least in this queue that the New York Times put together, their own version of it. So the most affordable income, I don't know what the median house is, but the city is Pittsburgh. We're talking the 50 largest cities in the country. $37,660 income to afford a median price home in Pittsburgh. Cleveland, it's $40,438. Oklahoma City, $41,335. Memphis, $41,401. Indianapolis, speak of the devil, $42,289. Louisville, $42,323. Cincinnati, $43,429. St. Louis, $44,216. Birmingham, Alabama, $44,593. And the least of the most affordable homes our incomes is Buffalo, New York, $45,689. So now let's work our way up along the top 10. How much you need in your household income to afford a median home in Portland, Oregon, $85,173. Denver, $91,672. Washington, D.C., $94,408. Okay, now we move into six figures. Seattle, $105,367. New York, surprises so far down the list, $105,684. Boston, $106,790. Los Angeles, where I am, $123,156 to afford a median price home. Stay tuned for the house next to me because you're going to be blown away. San Diego, $131,641 household income. San Francisco, not surprisingly, $198,978. And the winner of the most expensive market to buy a medium-priced house in. Here is the median home price in San Jose, California, $1,250,000. The needed income for that, $254,836 income. Okay, now stay with me here. So as you may have heard, just to recap, there has been a spec home going on, being built, being constructed, being dissected next to me for almost the last year. It started sometime in April 2018. We are now on March 22nd. I think they're done. They're doing open houses. So my girlfriend and I, our neighbor on the other side of the house, I should say, said, you got to go do an open house. Of course, part of the reason he said that is he wanted us to get some FaceTime with Dave, the builder, the guy responsible for this thing, who's trying to sell it and make a profit. And that way we can ask for things like the lights, the lights that are flooding out of their shades outside to be turned off and things like that. And let me explain. Bear with me again. So there are various ticky-tacky shade lamps, you know, on outside the garage and in the patio in the back, which is right adjacent to our bedroom and our backyard, as it were. And the way that the bulbs are installed, they go below the shade. So instead of shading down, they actually shade out. So the light, they don't shade, they light, illuminate out. They light up everything in their path, including our house. Plus, he had on all of the living room lights for most of the first week and that he was doing open houses. And that was coming into our study as well. So all to say, you know, we wanted to get rid of it. Long story short, I asked him after the open house, after I got his business card and left him a voicemail, and he took care of that for the time being. When the owner comes in, who knows what's going to happen. But so here's the other part of the story. And then I'll tell you finally how much this house is. So last Sunday, open house day, because Sunday's open house day, you know, 2 to 5 or whatever it is, 1 to 4. And I said to my girlfriend, do you want to go over there? And she's like, all right. So we go over there. Walk into the house, start looking, you know, the guy's friendly. Nobody else is doing an open house at the time. We start looking around, start giving ourselves a self-guided tour. And he kind of calls up behind us as we walk up the stairs. He says, been looking long? And I said, not long. He said, do you live in the neighborhood? I said, yeah, we live in the neighborhood. Meanwhile, of course, all these thoughts cross your mind. Should I tell him that we have been suffering through the construction that you were responsible for the last year? What are you going to do about these lights? What are you going to do about this? What are you going to do about that? And of course, you know, when it comes down to this moment, you decide to be a little bit shy. That is ultimately in our civilized human nature. So finally, let me cut to the chase. So this is advertised as a four-bedroom, four-bathroom house. That fourth bathroom comes from a detached 229-square-foot flex room, is what they call it. It's really like a nicely done garage that has a bedroom and a half bathroom. And that's in the backyard, obviously. people might use it for Airbnb, very likely, in addition to having relatives stay there, you know, keeping a little distance from them. All right, so let's cut to the chase already. It's a 2,363-square-foot home plus that extra 229 square feet on the market for $2,199,000. $2,199,000. What do you get for that? Not a lot. There's no pool. There's no jacuzzi. It's a pretty bland front yard with bland ticky-tacky spec home gates and a bland cement patio between the back of the house and the garage and that little flex room thing. You know, they got it nicely sort of fluffed up and whatnot with the furniture and all that. But, you know, you look in the closets and it's wood laminate, you know, with white paint. You know, it doesn't have any character. Let's put it that way. It's not IKEA level quite, but not too many rungs above that. You know, without overanalyzing it, I think it's all location, location, location. It's near enough to Silicon Beach is what they call this area near here. And people working at Google in Venice or YouTube in, I guess, Playa Vista and Snapchat in Venice and maybe a couple of other companies. You know, these are the kinds of people that can afford it. And by the way, who can afford a $2 million home, or how much do you need to make for that kind of home? If you need $254,000 for a $1.25 million home. Well, I did a little searching around. I didn't get a very definitive answer, but one person on Quora said you need an income of at least $440,000 a year. So that gives you a bit of a ballpark. And let me just be clear here. I do not make anywhere in the universe of these kinds of dollars, as you probably already know. This is a rental. We have been here since 2005, and everything has increased in value as quote-unquote value exponentially since we've lived here. So that's how you have this island of below-market affordability in this sea of overpriced insanity. Yeah. So is that oversharing? I hope you guys found that illuminating and crazy. Let's get to the old news, shall we, before we run on for too long. So the old news for this week, just a couple of shorties before we jump into the big one from Tim Schneider. And this goes back to the conversation that Rainey, or the talk that Rainey and I had about museums. As museums fall in love with experiences, their core missions face redefinition. Experience has become a buzzword in marketing, and now it's museums' favorite noun, too. That comes from Naomi Ray. This comes from Art News. Stairway to Nowhere on the Pleasure of Hating Thomas Heatherwick's Vessel in Hudson Yards by Andrew Russeth, alum of the podcast, Andrew Russeth. And if you haven't seen pictures of the vessel, they are definitely making the rounds on Instagram because it finally made its public debut, I guess, this past week. And there is a lot of hate going around, if you have not heard. So do check it out. And if you have seen it yourself and you listen to this podcast, I really want to hear what you had to say about it. All right, so here comes the big one finally to wrap things up for this episode. What the College Admission Scandal Has to Do with the Art World by alum of this podcast and ArtNet reporter Tim Schneider. I'm going to try to give you the highlights and not cover absolutely everything from the piece. On Tuesday, Renee Reisman at Hyperallergic reported on a protest held by students at CalArts in response to news that annual tuition will balloon to $50,850 this fall. The demonstration took place outside Hauser & Wirth's Los Angeles complex, where CalArts officials and trustees, gallery co-president Yuan Wirth is among the latter group, convened to approve the budget for the 2019-2020 academic year. According to Reisman, tuition accounts for about 75% of CalArts' annual budget, and the price has escalated by almost $10,000 in the last 5 years. In recognition of the students' concerns, school officials did make a quintet of concessions, Reisman wrote. In the five-point resolution, the board promises more transparent communication to include more faculty, staff, and student voices in their decision-making process, immediate reevaluation of financial aid packages for continuing students who demonstrate the most need, and future commitment to analyzing and improving the distribution of financial aid and need for increased tuition. However, as Tim points out, these shifts do relatively little to address the root cause of the students' unrest, namely the dizzying annual price of attending CalArts. Personally, I care much more about whether the school is going to keep firing a catastrophic debt bazooka at a bunch of students' futures than about how tactfully those students are going to be notified that another, bigger shell is about to be loaded into the chamber. This isn't just an art school problem, though. The price of attending a four-year university has increased almost 8 times faster than wages in the U.S. since 1989. To his credit, CalArts president Ravi S. Rajan recognized his school is both guilty in itself and part of a much larger crisis, based on his comments to Hyperallergic. Student precarity has been normalized not just at CalArts, but also the whole industry, he said, referring to the mounting student debt nationwide. We talked about how CalArts says it is radical and how it's a different school, but still it's following the same status quo. On the same day, the CalArts protesters rallied outside Hauser & Wirth, Los Angeles. Quote, federal prosecutors charged 50 people in a brazen scheme to buy spots in the freshman classes at Yale, Stanford, and other big-name schools, unquote, according to the New York Times. The dragnet, known as Operation Varsity Blues, caught 33 wealthy parents, including former Full House co-star Lori Loughlin, former Desperate Housewives actress Felicity Huffman, and rainmaker William E. McGlashan Jr. of private equity powerhouse TPG. The college admissions sting shows that the problem with elite higher education isn't just cost, it's also exclusivity. Even students with the academic credentials and the theoretical willingness to pay, whether through loans or scholarships, won't necessarily get into a good college or grad school because there simply aren't enough spaces, especially when less deserving students' parents can just buy spots on the black market. And of course, the scarcity of spots only drives the price of tuition and, it turns out, bribes higher. Art School puts an even finer point on the issue. There, thousands of students effectively buy a stealth luxury product premised on exclusivity, an MFA, to give themselves the best chance at a career of producing stealth luxury products premise on exclusivity, artworks in the gallery system. The snake eats its own tail. I don't say any of this to trivialize the intentions of young artists, most of whom I believe are genuinely trying to do work that matters, or art school faculty, most of whom I believe are genuinely trying to help their students achieve that goal. I say it to highlight that good people can easily get trapped in bad systems. And it's painfully clear at this point that designing a worse system than the MFA economy might take an actual con man. Nowhere is this more apparent than the recently announced MFA Fair, which will debut in November at New York's Pier 36. The concept is simple. Up to 65 art schools will pay $10,000 to $20,000 each to participate in what is essentially a combined trade show and college fair. Their newest MFA grads will get to sell their work in booths, just like dealers at, say, the Armory Show, and the institutions themselves will get to pitch their debt traps, grad programs, to prospective students. Confirmed participants already include vaunted schools like Columbia, Virginia Commonwealth, and the Cranbrook Academy. The MFA Fair may represent the educational endpoint of the American art economy. On paper, it addresses artists' urgent need to professionalize ASAP and art schools' urgent need to replenish their supplies of fresh customers year after year. And it's all for the same reason. Everyone needs the money worse than ever. But of course, the artists wouldn't need the money so badly if the schools didn't cost so much. So who is this helping more? In theory, the MFA Fair at least makes the art economy somewhat more of a meritocracy, since artists can start to meet collectors and make sales without needing to penetrate the hyper-exclusive, frequently biased gallery system first. But even this idea is fiction, in more ways than one. Many young people today now think the concept of an American meritocracy is a joke. The pipeline to a high-level education is still too often determined by who can pay tuition, which of course means that a university system changes little about who gets to succeed in society. So meritocracy is just a kind of Santa Claus myth by and for the rich, a matter of inventing a plausible middleman to distract a target audience from the way that wealth is actually being transferred between generations. All of the above converges via an undermaligned figure in the college admissions debacle. Writer Anand Giridharadas points out that although Lori Loughlin and Felicity Huffman have grabbed all the headlines because of their TV and film histories, William McGlashan Jr. represents the most important indictment. And if you're surprised two women would get positioned as the main ridicule magnets in a gender-inclusive scam, don't be. McGlashan matters so much because for years, he has been one of the most prominent carnival barkers for so-called conscious capitalism, in which plutocrats pledge to use ethical and impact investing to, quote, empower the poor, fight inequality, and create opportunities, unquote, for the less fortunate. But while McGlashan was preaching this new gospel of wealth on conference panels and televised interviews, he now stands accused of paying $250,000 to steal his child a spot at the University of Southern California that would otherwise rightfully go to a less fortunate applicant. In that sense, he represents, at least in the abstract, the type of hypocrisy that so much of the art economy stands on. Those crafty philanthropists who donate money and works to museums to art wash the unsavory sources of their fortunes. Those unprincipled gallerists who pontificate about having their artists' best interests at heart to distract from their accounting and business shenanigans. Those collectors who throw themselves moral victory parades to hide how much pure speculation is driving their late-coming decisions to acquire works by women and artists of color. So much of it is about head-faking the world into believing there is no aristocracy, and that, even if there is, we have nothing to fear from our benevolent overlords. But like the ring of fraudsters McGlashan is accused of joining, the scam runs deeper than most of us like to imagine, inside and outside the arts alike. And our schools are the ultimate lesson of that. And that, again, is Tim Schneider on ArtNet. Thank you, Tim. Thank you guys very much for listening. Obviously, a lot of that to be continued. And lastly, if you guys are still listening, for those of you who are, coming up, I will tell you right now, very excited about the guest Max Haven, who is a Canadian-based cultural critic, among other things, professor. The author of the book, Art After Money, Money After Art. And it's going to be a multi-episode conversation, actually. So all that to say that that's what you have to look forward to. And if you happen to have read this book or would like to prepare for those conversations, that's the name of it. Chicago Press is the publisher. And you happen to have any questions, start forming them now because we will be recording again in a few weeks. Thank you guys again for listening. Happy spring. And I will talk to you in a couple of weeks. Ciao for now.